This Week in Chicago History is sponsored by UChicagoMedicine.org, and Herald City Hall seat was filled back in 1989. Let's talk about it. Good morning, Anna DeVlantis.
Good morning, Bob. Think back to 1989, Bob, and that's right. Major change at the top for Chicago this week, 1989. Mayor Daley was sworn in, Richard M. Daley. You wouldn't have known it at the time. He'd serve for just about as long as his father, Richard J. Daley, who Mike Royko called him boss, famously, as you'll recall, because of his long tenured iron grip on the city. But the younger Daley had been a rising star. He was Cook County State's attorney. He lost to Harold Washington, then beat Mayor Sawyer, his replacement, when Mayor Washington tragically died. And then in the primary, the general, he beat Alderman Tim Evans and Alderman Eddie Verdoliak to take on the role of mayor. He won it with a majority, with a margin of a 14% lead, I should say. And he did it by promising unity, a departure from the bitter council wars that had characterized the city over those years and the divisiveness. He wanted to talk about solutions, not infighting and name-calling. And we pulled a clip of Mayor Daley's, one of his TV ads, when he was running for election.
In some of our schools, it's easier to get drugs than an education. Kids are murdered on the street for resisting gangs. People are afraid to ride the CTA. As state's attorney, I put gang leaders in jail and increased drug prosecution by 500%. But we need more, tougher laws, better police technology, and a mayor who will lead all of Chicago in the battle for safe streets and drug-free schools.
It was quite a shock when he announced he was going to not run again, remember?
Remember how shocked we all were? I remember I'd seen him out at a restaurant the day before or something, and I just thought, he looks really happy. And then
yeah.
The next day I saw he announced, but, you know, 22 years he served for the city, and one year longer than his father, who died in his 21st year in office. But a long-serving mayor, and interesting to go back and think about the roots of his early election, Bob.
This also was a big week for television nationally, because a franchise started right here in Chicago back in 2012. Let's talk about Dick Wolf's Moneymakers.
Yes, you know, you think about, Bob, it's hard to even imagine, remember what it was like before we had Chicago Med, Chicago PD, Chicago Fire, and all these things filming in our city. And think about the economic impact of everything that's brought to our city and so many other things, too. But this was big. It was a big week. It was 2012, and the pilot for Chicago Fire got picked up by NBC this week in 2012, and it featured some of the same famous faces that became, you know, well-known in the show. Jesse Spencer, Taylor Kinney was in it, a.k.a. Lady Gaga's former boyfriend. The pilot episode also featured Mayor Rahm Emanuel playing himself. True story, a Dick Wolf said, you know, you keep going off script, Mayor. You know, you're doing this. You got to stay on script. No F-bombs, I'm told, but he did have some improvisation. And he was part of it, and whatever magic they all sprinkled on that episode, it worked, because that was 12 years ago. Series just got picked up for a 13th season, and Dick Wolf, here he is, the creator himself, at the Broadcast Museum here in Chicago, explaining why he wanted to set the series and he wanted to actually do the shooting right here in the city of Chicago.
The idea for Fire first started, it was, where was it going to be placed? And obviously I'd spent a long time in New York, but Rescue Me had just gone off, and it's a very different show. We don't have ghosts, and it's a half hour versus an hour, but I knew that if we put it in New York, everybody would compare it. And also the values that these shows exemplify and embody are really the values of the heart of America. And that's what Chicago is.
And Dick, if I can, how has it been working with Chicago PD and Chicago Fire, the real guys out there on the street?
One of the reasons that Chicago Fire works is that anytime you see people who are not our cast members taking people stuff off of trucks or attaching hoses, they're real off-duty Chicago firemen. It not only adds to the truth of the story, but it makes for really good relations. They understand what we're doing.
And Allison Rosati, one of my former TV wives, asking a question.
Yes.
There. And let's see, they just renewed one of those shows, didn't they?
Yeah, they renewed Chicago Fire, 13th season, and, you know, Chicago PD is still out there, Chicago Med is. You know, Bob, you just think about what a tremendous impact those franchises have had for our city. They shoot almost entirely here. CineSpace is where they do the soundstage stuff. All of the entertainment workers, I've talked to many of them myself, they don't have to leave to go to Hollywood. They can get jobs right here in their hometown, you know, and just really good jobs. Plus, the economic impact of just having these shows spend so much in our city. It's just been a really, really cool relationship that started way back then.
And it helps all kinds of businesses around here for sure. It's our Wednesday visit with Anna DeVlantis for This Week in Chicago History. And this is fascinating. Let's talk about a little music and Ravinia's beginnings, Anna.
You know, you go way back to 1872 for this, Bob, you know, and thank a group of founders who got together over a century ago this week to create these really extensive plans for that property, you know, acquiring all the land that is now known as Ravinia. And it was 1872, not long after the Chicago Fire, and plans were being laid everywhere across the city and also in Highland Park. And this group of real estate investors and developers decided that this was such pristine property, wooded and naturally beautiful, and they wanted to establish a community away from Chicago. It wasn't very populated out there at the time. That was like a nature preserve where people would live, this idyllic community. But it failed ultimately after they built it because there was an economic downturn and people didn't flock out there to live. But then this large swath of beautiful land was acquired by Highland Park at the city, and they decided that they would make it start running the opera festival, the Ravinia Opera Festival, out of there. So for years, it became a place for amazing classical music, sitting on the lawn, just as we all enjoy now. And they also had an artist community, like a colony there, where they lived in cottages on the land, too. 1936, it became the official summer home for Chicago Symphony Orchestra, which it still is today. And then the Ravinia folks decided, what if we mixed in a little jazz, little other kinds of music? Wouldn't that be great, too? Benny Goodman came to perform and drew the largest audience ever. Here's a little clip we pulled from local TV special in the 1960s on Chicago television describing it.
Are you surprised to hear jazz at Ravinia? Many people are. They tend to think of this North Shore Pavilion as a haven for the long hair set. The long hairs are getting used to the sounds of Dave Brubeck and Oscar Peterson and Pete Fountain and many others. Actually, there isn't very much new about Ravinia mixing the classical with the popular. As long as 30 years ago, in fact, they broke the tradition when the pavilion was filled with a new kind of music. It was the 25th of July in 1936. And Ravinia audience turned out to hear an American composer, George Gershwin, and his jazz classic, Rhapsody in Blue. The sound of jazz had come to Ravinia. Benny Goodman's clarinet transcended the smoke-filled dance floors of the late 30s to perform in concert at Ravinia and to allow the symphony orchestra a night off. His concert brought the park the largest attendance in its history.
Wow. Norman Ross on Channel 7. I never knew any of this history. It's fascinating.
Isn't it cool to think about it? And now, you know, he broke the mold, because now you can hear anybody from Carrie Underwood to Mavis Staples to ZZ Top. It's just, you know, it's just incredible what it has evolved into, right? I just love going to Ravinia.
Yeah, they've got a good lineup for this summer, too. Let's talk about what was, at one time, the Midwest's number one selling bread.
So, bunny bread. Does Marianne let you have bunny bread, Bob?
I don't know about bunny bread.
Does she buy those healthy wheat, oat, nut bread?
I know. I'm off all bread now, according to her.
No bread. Yeah. So you can't hear this story because it might make you hungry for bread, but others can. The bunny bread, the genesis of this bread is just so cool. It has a little bunny on the packaging, which so many of us will remember from years ago. It was the Lewis family in Anna, Illinois, my namesake town, and it's actually Southern Illinois, of course, but it was they created this bunny bread. Originally, it was called milkmaid bread. They mortgaged their house. They made this delicious bread, and Chicagoans just ate it up. So it was interesting because when they put the bunny on the packaging, a lot of people just started calling it bunny bread, this cute little bunny. He was like, oh, let's get the bunny bread. So they renamed it, rebranded it, and we pulled the original TV ad from 1950 for the launch of bunny bread.
While folks in town are sleeping sound and stars are twinkling above them, the busy
folks at a bakery have fresh bunny in the oven. That's what I said. Bunny bread.
I don't remember that, but I'll have to ask Landecker about it. I think Bunny Bread once sponsored the Boogie Check, but I'm not sure.
When we get time, though, Bob, I also want to know who your favorite TV wife was. I know we don't have time right now, but maybe that's something we can revisit.
Yeah, too bad we don't have time for that now. Now, this is really interesting because I didn't realize that the largest public housing project in the country was the Robert Taylor Homes.
Yeah, you know, Robert Taylor Homes unveiled in 1967 this week, at the time, largest public housing project in the country, and at the time believed to be a solution, a tremendously good solution for the future of affordable housing. We know now that didn't turn out to be the case, but designed to house over 25,000 people, 28 high-rise buildings in clusters, 16 stories high. And at the time, they proudly unveiled them. Here's Mayor Daley at the time on WGN-TV saying, hey, this is the future.
This project represents the future of a great city. It represents vision. It represents what all of us feel America should be, and that is a decent home for every family in every great community, yes, and in the rural areas as well. We know that this community means a better environment in which the future generation of a great city will be raised. And we know also it means not only recreation, but it also means education. The education of these young is the greatest asset we in this city have.
Yeah, just didn't work out, did it?
Didn't work out. Buildings fell into disrepair. People were isolated in poverty and so many things, segregated, breeding ground for gang recruitment. It just turned out to not be what everyone had thought, and housing policies have shifted since. But interesting to go back and to that moment in time. And, you know, it's a moment in history.
This Week in Chicago History with Anna DeVellantis. And, of course, Anna, you were my favorite TV wife.
Oh, no, thank you, Bob. I wanted to hear that.
Talk to you next week.